which is 02-14-16, Julia Cole versus Hubanks. Representing Julia Cole is Jonathan, and is it Cimelli? Mr. Cimelli, you may proceed.
Thank you.
I note that there five of your first 25 minutes is shared by John F. Fuchs, representing the Police Officers Defense Fund at the Milwaukee Police Association.
That is correct.
Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here again. This case is significant to me and the individuals I work with. The defense in this case has asked you to affirm the trial court's ruling, which applied and expanded what we know as the firefighters' rule beyond firefighters, its historical application, beyond its application to EMTs that occurred as a result of Justice Wilcox's opinion in Pinter, and now to police officers. Obviously, I disagree. I don't think it should happen. I think at the core of the defendant's arguments are principles that this court almost 30 years ago in Gilson versus Dries Brothers and Polsky versus Levine got rid of, implied assumption of risk principles. In order for the defendant to have this rule apply to police officers, the defendant must make the argument that it should apply to cops because of the nature of their job, the risks that are inherent in their profession, and the risks that they are confronted with on a daily basis. That, to me, smacks of assumption of risk, implied assumption of risk. And you folks long ago got rid of that.
But
feel free,
question,
sir.
That since you mentioned Pinter, basically the decision there was a policy decision, public policy, based on, in Pinter, you had the EMT who went to an accident, and of course the person that he pulled out of the car, he strained his back, and then he sued the person that was in the accident. Do you see, so it really wasn't an assumption of risk, it was basically a public policy decision. Do you see that a problem here with that?
I see that a big problem with the defendant's argument. The way I see Pinter is there was a considerable amount of time spent in analogizing the firefighter to the EMT and how they often do the same work. The court made reference to them being professional rescuers and then made reference to them being trained to confront danger. But the key to Pinter occurred in paragraph 47, when this court said, look, let's look at the Haas public policy. Haas said it would place too great a burden on negligent fire starters to allow tort recovery from a firefighter injured as a result of that negligent fire. We can apply it to Pinter because it would place too great a burden on negligent drivers in these circumstances. Why would it place too great a burden? Why would it enter a field that has no just or sensible stopping point? All policy issues. It's because the causal connection was simply too attenuated. In Pinter, as I read it, what the plaintiff there was asking this court to do is say, look, but for the negligence of the driver, there wouldn't have been an accident, and I wouldn't have been called, and I wouldn't have had to respond, and I wouldn't have had to hold her in the precarious situation, and I wouldn't have injured my back. That's a but-for causal connection. We don't do that anymore. So I see Pinter as really being a foreseeability issue, and it was on public policy grounds that the firefighter's rule was applied. Personally, I don't know that the court needed to get to the firefighter's rule to get the same result in Pinter, because it was a foreseeability issue. And getting back to my argument, it seems to me since Haas and the cases that came after it and ended in Pinter dealt specifically with public policy. The court at its various stages was very careful to say, look, other versions, other states' versions might apply assumption of risk, but we don't. We don't do it. We apply it on the public policy basis that, one, it would place too great a burden on negligent fire starters, and as a result would enter a field that has no just or sensible stopping point.
Counsel, when you say public policy, I want to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. I think you are referring to the public policy considerations that are set forth in a number of cases, including Rockwhite, which is one, of course, Justice Wilcox's case, you know, no stopping point, too great a burden, you know, too remote, those kinds of, I think, six public policy considerations. There may be, there may be seven, I may miscount. But that's the way you're using the phrase public policy or the words public policy. You don't mean, oh, it's good public policy to enact a statute that keeps firefighters from doing something or police officers from doing something in a generic sense. Am I correct in the way you're using that term, public policy?
Yes, ma'am, you are. The Kala versus Mandela factors, in other words, where you could have a tort claim. You've got a duty, a breach of duty, a causal connection, a substantial factor. You can still deny recovery based on public policy issues. And Haas said, if you will, even though there was that causal connection, and even though the negligent fire starter had a duty of ordinary care, we're going to stop it. I think to figure out whether this case, whether the firefighter's rule should apply to this case, you've got to try to figure out why Haas said it violated public policy to apply or tort liability to a negligent fire starter. Why would it place too great a burden on that negligent fire starter? Why would it enter a field that has no just or sensible stopping point? If you take a look at that, then we can decide whether or not it should be applied in this case. Unfortunately, Haas didn't really explain the underpinnings of that public policy.
Counsel, let me interrupt for a moment. Where would you put the emphasis here? Would you put the emphasis in looking at the public policy considerations on the police officer, or would you focus on the animal involved in this particular case?
I think you have to put the policy on, if you're going to apply the rule to police officers as a whole, you have to look at two things. What is the function of a police officer? What does a cop do?
So in other words, you'd focus on the police officer, not on the particular animal involved.
Yes, sir, I would. And I think that's what Haas did. That's what everybody else did. They focused on a firefighter fighting a fire. Now, it seems to me there were two overriding policy considerations that the court probably had in mind when it took those Kala versus Mandela factors. One was fires are very scary. They're scary in their scope, in their breadth. You can have a negligent fire starter. You can have a frying pan on the stove, and mom's in the, watching TV, and the baby knocks the fire pan over, causes a fire. Those things happen, but for an act of God or but for arson, those things happen because of negligence. And their breadth and their scope are scary because it happens to be a fire.
Well, if you put the emphasis on the police officer here, don't you undercut your reliance to some extent on the Milwaukee ordinances and on the statutes in Wisconsin in regard to dogs?
I have two goals here, sir. One is to make sure that the firefighter's rule does not apply to my client, Officer Cole. And to do so, I have to either demonstrate that the firefighter's rule should not apply at all to police officers, or if it does, show that Officer Cole's conduct in her pleading falls within the exceptions. I think we have done that in terms of demonstrating that if the firefighter's rule applies, her cause of action should still get to a jury, survive summary judgment, because the negligence about which she complains deals with violations of a state statute, violation of several municipal ordinances involving the restriction of dogs, chaining of dogs, duty to warn, etc. So she should survive summary judgment. And I think it's Wright versus Coleman that said, if it can be demonstrated, or Clark versus Corby, excuse me, if you can demonstrate at trial that the ordinance is meant to protect the plaintiff at trial, then you have the exception. I don't think it should have been applied to kick Officer Cole out on summary judgment.
Counselor, I want to get into the statute a little bit, because as I read
the briefs when they came in and the petition for review that had been filed earlier, I kept having the nagging question, are dog bites different from other hazards that police officers may suffer? And, of course, there is a statute that the legislature has set out where it's determined that if you own a dog and it bites someone, you're liable absent the defense of contributory negligence, or if you happen to let a dog that's supposed to be confined for observation loose. And I want to know, what effect do you think 17402 has? And to be very specific, what is bothering me is, can we apply a common law doctrine to block the liability choice that the legislature made in 17402 sub 1? And you didn't really talk about that much in your brief. The amicus brought it up, but I'd like you to tell me what you think about it today.
Thank you. I didn't talk about it much in my brief. I only had a limited amount of space. It's I think, a really good point. You've got the legislature speaking to something that's right on point with our case, our particular set of facts. And they're saying, look, you have a dog, it bites somebody, cop, mailman, whatever. Strict liability, that's it. Okay? Double bite, double damages. Legislature has spoken to that. To take a common law principle and try to get rid of what the legislature has deemed as appropriate policy is wrong. I don't think you can do that. And the same thing with the ordinances, to a certain extent, those ordinances, they don't supplant the statute, but they back up the reasoning behind the statute. These animals, I have a dog, I love it, but they're dangerous. That's why we pay added insurance. That's why the municipalities have written ordinances saying what you need to do to protect others. And I think others includes police officers.
Well, counsel, just question she raised, they have a specific statute, strict liability dogs. What if it was a, in the paper the other day I saw, what if it was a snake? It was in the paper today where the officer rescues a snake. A police officer has a general obligation to do a lot of different things and doesn't really know what he or she is going to run into tomorrow. Would it make a difference as far as the animal, whether it was a dog or a snake?
Then you get into the broader issue of whether the firefighter rule at all should apply to police officers as opposed to this specific dog bite set of facts.
But that's what we have here. We have a specific statute which could take this out of the general
category. It could, and that's certainly one way to deal with this issue. I don't know what this court wants to do. I don't know if this court wants to, what was certified to come up is should the firefighter rule apply to the police officers, I believe. I think it's important to look at the functions of a firefighter and the functions of a cop.
Okay, let me just pose this. When I read these materials, it's been a long time since we've had a firefighter case here. When I read these materials, I thought to myself, you're asking for too much. The police officer gets disability. Police officer knows this is a dangerous job, right? I know it's a dangerous job. It could be dangerous from a criminal. It could be dangerous from a nice citizen on the street. It could be danger from a nice dog on the street. You know that. You take the job. You're probably underpaid for those risks, but you take the job. You get disability income. You get time off if you're disabled. You get workers' comp. You get various retirement benefits. Why, too, should we allow, and this is what I'm thinking out loud, so I'm going to tell you, why, too, should we allow more litigation in the courts, more tort litigation in the courts, to compensate the police officer? And I thought I had the case all figured out until I read my dissent.
It's just looking at
it. So I read my dissent. Pinter and said, it's possible I could be dead wrong. I changed my mind.
and I'm, Pintner might, I may have been wrong, but you already wrote an interesting and good opinion. So, here's my deal. I want you to persuade me that it is good law under general negligence law, that you should give police officers the same rights for common law torts that you do every other person except firefighters and EMTs.
Sure.
And then I want you to persuade me, if that's true, that what you do is you sort out the problems of each particular case under the facts of that case, so that maybe this officer is going to get nothing when a jury decides because she was negligent. And that's where you sort it out, not here as a matter of public policy.
We, first of all, I don't think your dissent in Pintner was wrong. I think that you don't apply this to police officers because you don't apply it to any other municipal employee who's paid to, quote-unquote, confront risks associated with the job. The only one you do is firefighters, all right? We've got a host of other municipal employees who have the same benefits that cops do, okay, and they're not prevented from suing where cops would be if this rule is applied. Firefighters are prevented from suing because the sole reason a firefighter exists is to remedy negligent conduct and fire that arises because of fires, absent an arson or an act of God. This court has recognized that fires always occur because of negligence. And the only reason a firefighter exists is to remedy that negligence and save people. All right? So we've said, or this court has said, given those duties, we're not going to allow the firefighter to sue in one context and one context only, and that's for the negligent starting of a fire. Police officers, on the other hand, they confront danger, they deter it, they arrest bad guys. That's their function. Might they get into a negligent situation once in a while? Perhaps, but it's negligence that would arise as a result of purposeful conduct or intentional acts. And I don't think that's the kind of action that this court wants to immunize. Perhaps, I mean, 33 years ago, this court says we're going to immunize a landowner if he negligently starts a fire, only to the extent that a firefighter can't sue for starting that negligence if he's hurt. We're not going to immunize the landowner for failing to warn. We're not going to immunize the landowner for doing other things, for having a bad acetylene tank on his property. But we're going to immunize him for only that purpose and only against firefighters.
Now, counsel, since you agreed with the dissent in Pintner, I just want to ask you a question. Basically, in Pintner, we were talking about an EMT who went to an accident and extracted a person. What EMTs go to accidents? They help. That's their job. And in extracting the person, he hurt his back. So the idea was he wanted to sue the person that had the auto accident who was trapped in the car. Now, that's what the majority said. It was very limited, narrow opinion. At least that was my opinion about it. What is the difference here that you're trying to explain other than the statutory obligation of a person who has a dog that's strict liability? What's the difference between that case and this case?
I think Pintner's sole function was to help this injured individual. The court analogized his actions, his duties, his responsibility to that of firefighters. This case is different. This case and police officers are different because they don't deal with negligence but once in a while. I have thought for about a year and a half, what kind of circumstances can I come up with when a cop is going to deal with the negligent conduct of somebody that isn't purposeful negligent conduct? And the only thing I can think of is basically this case, and perhaps when an officer pulls over somebody to give him a ticket and he's injured by a third driver, a third party. And there are cases out of Iowa, out of Michigan, that have dealt with that situation and applied the firefighter's rule. I don't think you need to do that because in those cases, all right, you can get rid of, if it's appropriate to get rid of that tort action by means of foreseeability. Well, not.
This is what I want to talk about. I'm sure that many people have owned, I've owned dogs for 30 years, and I don't have one now, but I can say anybody that's owned a dog, sometime that dog has gotten away, whether it's on a leash, whether it was out on the street. And you talk about foreseeability, is it just because that dog was at that time vicious in the sense that he bit this particular officer? That's what you seem to be hanging it on, the expectation of the officer and the duty. And I'm just saying that this is a rather common thing, a dog running down the street dragging a chain. I think that dog owners would say, you know, that happens a lot, and that's just an expectation that's out there.
But why should we treat a police officer any differently than you or I who might be bitten by that dog?
Do they have an obligation to pick up that dog?
They do, as do a host of other municipal employees. But simply because you have an obligation to pick up that dog, and it might be one in 10,000 statutory obligations you've got as a cop, why should that be a complete bar to bring a lawsuit? Maybe Officer Call was contributorily negligent. I don't think so, but I'm sure Ms. Cain would argue that. And isn't that really what should be at issue here? If she assumed some sort of risk expressly by approaching that dog that has a broken chain on it, well, then that goes to her contributory negligence. It should not bar her from getting to a jury. I noticed that my red light is on, and I'm told I should sit down.
That's a good idea. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Froman representing... I'm sorry, it's not Mr. Froman. I'm looking at the next case. Mr. Fuchs representing the Police Office Defense Fund and the Milwaukee Police Association has 5 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, it occurs to me that I came up here to spend 5 minutes to very specifically address the question posed by Justice Abramson. But I feel very privileged to do that on behalf of just not a single plaintiff, but on behalf of police officers. And I think of the word policy, and I think of the criteria, the questions that are raised by the decisions. What is the sensible starting point? What is the sensible stopping point? I first wonder, if this rule is extended, will it abrogate not just a statute about dog bites, but will it someday abrogate the Safe Place Law? Where is the sensible stopping point? That triggers the question of where is the right starting point. I have to ask, and I wish I had had the opportunity to ask the circuit court, why the court felt compelled to make this extension. Why would we, in terms of a sensible starting point, take those who face a higher risk and give them a lesser right of recovery? Why would we call it an assumption of a risk? I know we've abrogated the legal concept, but in terms of factually what we're talking about is, are they assuming a risk? I think the more correct phrasing as to police officers is not that they're assuming a risk, but they're assuming a duty on our behalf that is attended by risk. The idea that, well, you took the job, if I can address that head on, I don't think a person takes the job saying, I'm doing this knowing I'm the one that's specifically getting hurt. If the human mind really worked that way, nobody would buy a lottery ticket. When I buy a lottery ticket, I'm crushed when I don't win. The odds mean nothing to me. The officer assumes that duty. The risk just comes with it. In terms of why should they have this right, police officers, if I can speak on their behalf, often wonder, doesn't that defendant have more rights than me? And in terms of public policy, I have to ask why a court, because there's no legislative enactment extending this rule to police officers, why a court, and I'm envisioning a hypothetical of chasing somebody as bad and as ugly as a rapist, and that person's injured, I negligently maintain stairs and can recover, but the police officer can't. They both get injured on the same stairs. Sensible stopping point. Will this rule go that far that we ever have such an awful situation?
Counsel, I have a specific question regarding your brief. In your brief, you cite to statute 174.02, which is the statute dealing with dog bites. There's a specific statute. Are you advancing the argument that that the specific statute here should result in the cause of action going forward? Is that what you're relying on?
Absolutely, but more.
I was going to ask, because if you're relying on that, then it seems to me you're saying unless there is a specific statute, the tortfeasor is immune. Unless there's a specific statute, the case cannot go forward. And I don't think that's your position, is it?
It is not my position, and if that's the inference that comes from that phrasing, then it's bad phrasing.
What do you mean to be, what are you arguing by any reference to 174.02 in your brief?
I'm arguing, and I'll preface it, I'm arguing that it is bad policy, period, to take those who incur these risks on our behalf and give them a lesser right. I'm arguing that in the specific context of the case, extending that policy, in my opinion, also eliminates what appears to be a statutorily given right to sue. It's kind of like the big picture and the small picture. In the big picture, I just question, why protect those whose negligence injures our police officers? In the small picture, the context of the brief, the statute cited, why extend a common law policy to negate what appears to be a legislatively granted right to sue subject to certain limitations? So it's the big and the small picture, and it's just the opportunity to ask you on behalf of those officers
and your argument then
not
is,
to go that route.
Your argument then in the brief should not be construed to mean unless there's a specific statute.
I cannot emphasize enough how much I do not want that to be an inference from the phrasing in the brief.
I'll tell you how I read your two briefs, or counsel's two briefs, and the majority, and the plaintiff's brief. One, you want to win. Two, if you have to, you'll take a narrow holding. State statute, training, etc. You would prefer that the holding be broader and exclude police officers at all times from the firefighters' rule.
That is exactly correct.
And four, which you don't say, because you're concerned about going that far, is the whole firefighters' rule is wrong, based on bad concepts that have been severely challenged by commentators and other case law, and we ought to dump the whole thing.
In terms of the position I'm taking, recognizing that I'm facing both a majority opinion and a dissenting opinion.
You don't want to go that far.
Actually, I would. Let me not equivocate, and let me say to this court that limiting the rights of those who lay it on the line for us is bad policy, period.
But you don't have to go that far to get your clients out of this.
I'm not getting any younger, and the idea of a half a loaf has not escaped me.
Okay.
But
thank
the policy is bad. Thank you,
counsel.
Ms. Kane, Janet E. Kane, counsel for Hugh Banks et al.
Thank you. As you know, my name is Janet Kane, and I represent the respondents in this case, Yvonne and Aubrey Hugh Banks, and American Family Mutual Insurance Company. This case is based on a simple record. There were undisputed facts, and this case was certified to this court from the Court of Appeals with one question. does the Wisconsin Firefighters Rule, first adopted in Haas versus Chicago and Northwestern Railway, and later expanded by Pinter versus American Family Insurance Company, to include emergency medical technicians within the scope of the rule, bar a police officer from suing the owners of a stray dog for injuries sustained while capturing the dog? This case was decided by the trial court on a motion for summary judgment. The trial court analyzed the prior decisions of this court, as well as the Court of Appeals, as well as courts from other jurisdictions, and found that allowing police officers to sue for the negligence of citizens which necessitates their services, quote, is not in line with the public policy recognized by the firefighters' rule, end quote, and granted summary judgment to the respondents.
Counselor, I want to stop you right there. What are the policies, as you see them, that underlie the firefighters' rule?
The two public policies set forth by the Haas Court were that allowing recovery would place too great a burden on, in that case, homeowners who negligently start a fire, and that allowing recovery would enter a field with no just stopping point.
Well, wasn't, I think that there was more to that first one, Counselor, unless I read the case differently than you, and that there was not a burden placed on the property owners because it, having them report the fire promptly, rather than being concerned that they would be sued for their own negligence, served the societal purpose of protecting us all, because fires can easily get out of hand and easily affect many more people than those who initially started the fire through negligence. Isn't that correct?
That's true, and I think that that is a public policy which, in this, under the facts of this particular case, makes perfect sense, because here we have a case where my clients allegedly allowed their dog, or did allow their dog, to get out of their yard. And if the police officer is allowed to maintain a cause of action against the owners of the dog, I think it's reasonable to assume that if this situation occurs again, these dog owners might very well say to themselves, you know what? My dog's gotten out.
Yeah, but your client didn't report this dog. This officer picked the dog up by happenstance, right? It wasn't because he was out looking for the dog, because your client reported it like someone reported the house was burning down.
That's true. And there's no evidence as to whether my clients even knew their dog was gone at the time that it had escaped. But what I'm getting at is, if a police officer is allowed to sue a dog owner under these circumstances, a dog owner might very well say, you know what, I think my dog is going to come home, and it's not going to cause injury to anyone. Why should I call the police to come and try to catch my dog and put myself at risk for a suit by that police officer against me if my dog does something to that police
officer? How
about
a suit by a lot of other people that could be bitten that obviously the rule wouldn't apply to, but the statute certainly does?
Well, and you're right.
That might promote a report, right?
That may or may not. It depends on the particular circumstances involving the dog and what people think about their dog and whether or not they're inclined to believe that their dog would injure someone. But
do you think this case is any different because there's a statute that is obviously bothering me, I don't know how much it's bothering my colleagues, than a case where it's simple negligence that causes eventually a police officer's injury?
No, I don't think that a distinction should be made in this case because of Section 174.02, which imposes strict liability on a dog owner when that dog injures another person. Because strict liability under the statute simply means that a dog owner is going to be held to be negligent, causally negligent, and if this case were to go to trial, let's say it wasn't a police officer and we weren't here arguing public policy issues, I couldn't try to say my clients were not negligent. Those questions would be answered yes. And we're beyond the point of determining negligence. Just like in Haas, there was ordinary negligence in Haas. In this case, there's strict liability. In both cases, the negligence is established for purposes of the argument and for purposes of your decision on whether or not public policy should apply. So I don't think the fact that this was a violation of a statute should play any role in the decision as to whether the public policy reasons, which are to be applied by this court, even when you assume negligence plus cause. As Justice Sykes stated in a recent dissenting opinion, there are times when negligence plus cause plus damages do not equal liability. And that's essentially what Haas was saying 30 years ago.
And the application of public policy limitations on liability presupposes negligence liability.
Absolutely. And that's why we don't need a trial to be here. We should be deciding this issue without a trial because it's not a question of negligence.
And in the context of this statute, the court is already on record as applying a public policy analysis for limitations on liability where there otherwise would be liability under this statute. In the sleeping dog case, isn't that right?
In the what?
In the sleeping dog case, where
that's
there would
right,
be there. Liability, the guy who tripped over the sleeping dog. I can't remember the name of the case.
Alwyn.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Right.
Tell us about that case.
Well, in that case, there was a, I think it was a mother-in-law or mother of someone was over eating dinner at their son or daughter-in-law's house, and a dog decided to take a nap right behind the chair of the mother or mother-in-law, and when she got up, she tripped over the dog and fell, and the court decided that despite the fact that 174.02 imposes strict liability on dog owners when they injure someone, for public policy reasons, the court wasn't going to impose liability on the owner of a sleeping dog.
Again, you are using the phrase to follow up on Justice Sykes' question. You are using the term, rather, public policy to refer to the public policy limitations on liability. In this case, as you noted, we have negligence established. And when you employ public policy in the analysis of this case, it is not in the context of what's good public policy. Should we protect firefighters, or should we protect police officers? That's not the way you're using public policy in this case, as I understand it. You are, when you refer to public policy in your analysis and argument, you're referring to the public policy limitations on liability which presuppose negligence. Is that correct?
That's right, and that's exactly what Haas and Pinter and all the other courts who have addressed this issue in Wisconsin have relied on, that those public policy considerations.
Ms. Kane, we had adopted the firefighters rule, and except for Pinta, and this is under the certification memo that the Court of Appeals said, as I remember it, it said every other case limited the application of the firefighters rule. That Pinta was the only expansion. And that the whole trend in our cases has been to keep the firefighters rule limited because of its, what some people might consider, a shaky foundations. Do you agree with that analysis of our cases, or don't you?
I do.
Okay. So, if that's been our trend, now we reversed that trend in Pittner and applied it to an EMT and analogized the EMT to a firefighter. Shall we continue that trend to expand the rule here, or don't you view this as an expansion?
I view this as a very limited expansion. And why? The reason I say that is because the basis for the rule is still the same, whether it be applied to a firefighter, an EMT, or a police officer. And what I mean by that is the firefighter's rule will only preclude suit by a firefighter, police officer, or EMT when that suit is based on the original negligence which necessitated their services. The cases that have come between Haas and Pinter, and I think there were three of them, and then one after Pinter, have gone into an analysis of why in those cases, even though we have the firefighter's rule, those lawsuits were allowed to proceed because there was some intervening act of negligence, or the reason that the professional firefighter was hurt wasn't because of the reason he was called there in the first place. So although this is, I think it would be difficult to argue it's not an expansion when I'm asking that the rule be applied to a whole new class of people, I think it's still a very limited rule, and it's justified in this case because of the similarity between police officers' roles in the community and firefighters' roles in the community.
Let me just follow up with that, because if we apply the firefighters' rule here, how do we fashion it so that, for example, I was looking at your opponent's brief on page 30 and 31, there are six examples given. One of them is the DNR warden who would be prevented from suing for a gunshot wound that resulted in negligent actions of a hunter, where he's called out. Now, this is law enforcement, but he's just out there in the field and someone accidentally shoots him. How would we fashion this rule to, we talk about the slippery slope, to allow recovery, or the school teacher who somebody pushes him or her around in the hallway from suing, those types of cases that are mentioned on page 30 and 31?
I think the way to limit the rule, while still applying it to police officers, is to look at the primary function of whatever occupation it is we're talking about.
Let me just ask then, because I was thinking of primary function, but example, a public school safety official who's being sued for some unruly students. In other words, his or her primary function is to maintain order in the school. They're not a police officer. And what's the difference there?
A school is not the type of environment that typically involves danger. I'm not saying danger never occurs
in schools. That's open to question sometimes.
Pardon?
I mean, that may be open to question. That's why the officer or the person is there, because of those difficulties that have been there before. So I'm just trying to talk about the slippery slope argument and how we could limit it to, if we did apply it at all, to this situation.
We have to look at the, like I said, the primary function of the occupation involved. Here, police officers, according to the Wisconsin Administrative Code, have a fundamental duty to serve humanity and to safeguard lives and property. And those other occupations that were mentioned by counsel in his brief don't primarily involve confronting danger on a regular basis. A nurse in a county hospital, for example, her primary job is to treat patients, although she may occasionally be confronted with danger by one of those patients. A teacher may occasionally have an unruly student. In fact, some courts have even said that EMTs, some courts outside of Wisconsin have even said that EMTs don't fall into the category of occupations which should be protected by the firefighters' rule, because they only peripherally involve facing danger. And so I think we have to look at whether the job is primarily focused in a situation where that individual is called upon to confront danger as a regular part of his or her job.
What about a teacher at Lincoln Hills or a corrections officer? Isn't the primary function of their job, besides teaching for the teacher, is to teach in an environment where there are kids who have been determined to be in need of a restrictive environment because of some kind of dangerousness, criminal activity, heightened dangerousness? How do you distinguish that? Or a corrections officer at that school, or a corrections officer at Columbia?
I guess I would have to know more about the specific job duties of these occupations before I could intelligently argue that they should or shouldn't be within the scope of the rule. But I think that for today's purposes, talking about police officers, it's clear that police officers do confront danger. They like firefighters, it's their job to confront danger, whether it be danger created by a negligent citizen or someone who intentionally.
Counselor, in that regard, and going back to what your opponent said, say there's a bank robbery.
and the police officer responds to a call to stop this robbery. It's part of his job. He comes in, and one of the robbers, in leaving, shoots the police officer. Under your rule, would the police officer not be able to sue the robber for damages?
No, because...
Well, then aren't you protecting bank robbers at the expense of police officers?
Oh, I misspoke. The police officer would be able to sue the bank robber because it wasn't a negligent act. It was an intentional act. And this rule only applies to negligent acts.
What about if his gun went off accidentally? What about if he didn't intend to shoot him and he's running out? We have, you know, in our statutes, felony murder, which is when someone's killed accidentally. So it doesn't always occur on purpose.
Well, that goes back to what I said about limiting the rule. The reason the police officer is at the bank isn't because of a negligent act by that bank robber. It's because of an intentional act by that bank robber. So it wouldn't fall within the firefighter's rule. He
so
wouldn't
you
be
would
able
limit
to
it only to conduct that's negligent that sets the train of injury in motion.
And that's exactly what Haas said.
Okay.
And that's exactly what the court decisions since Haas have said. And that's why the rule can be termed a limited rule.
Isn't that, I'm reminded of the game of semantics that we used to play in pleading and practice, you know, and I forget, something like in a intentionally drove but negligently injured, you know, that may not be the exact thing, but, you know, we'd parrot the words in order to get by any kind of motion to dismiss at a preliminary stage because we nuance the intentional versus negligent. And Justice Rogensack's hypothetical brought that to mind, you know. Intentionally rob or steal, but negligently injure those who are apprehending you.
Are you asking me whether if someone made that type of pleading, whether the cause of action would survive? Well, I think that in that situation, we would do a lot of discovery and come up with depositions and interrogatories and evidence to bring to the court on a motion for summary judgment or at the very least at the close of a plaintiff's case if we couldn't get by on a motion for summary judgment because I think there's only so much you can do when you've got a bank robbery to try to convince someone that your actions were negligent.
Was the Court of Appeals referring to... What was the Court of Appeals referring to, if you know, when in their conclusion they said, first sentence in, under their conclusion, paragraph, page 11 of the cert, this case could considerably broaden the class of individuals barred from suit under the firefighter's rule. And yet you indicate in your argument that, no, this is going to be a very limited expansion. How do you fill in the gap between the perception of the Court of Appeals and their cert in your response?
It would certainly broaden the class of people because police officers is a whole new group of people that would be subject to the rule. But it's limited in that I'm not asking that the rule be changed or expanded. I'm just asking that the rule be applied to
asking that the rule be applied to those whose primary function it is to confront danger and who are injured as a result of negligence? That's what I really hear your argument to be.
I'm saying that's what police officers do, and that's why it should be applied to police officers, yes. This court has extended the firefighter's rule to an emergency medical technician in the Pinter case because this court recognized that the public policy considerations from Haas were equally applicable to an emergency medical technician, even though he wasn't a firefighter. Now, we contend that those same public policy considerations are applicable to a police officer's suit against a negligent citizen, and therefore this court should affirm the trial court.
Now, in Pinter, the EMT, when we talk about your premise that danger. In the EMT case, it was basically that this person went out to an auto accident and when extracting someone hurt his back. Now this has to do with, this was within the job. This is what's, when you go out to an auto accident and to give aid, this is what, it's there. It's not so much danger as it was particularly what the person was doing, lifting a person out of a vehicle.
And I was just about to get to that, the issue of rescue and why this really isn't an issue that should rest on whether or not a rescue was occurring. The Haas case 33 years ago involved a firefighter who was injured while fighting a fire. Those are the facts as the court stated them. There is no mention that the firefighter was rescuing anyone in that case. The word rescue doesn't appear in that case. Then in the three cases between Haas and Pinter, wherein the court determined for one reason or another that the firefighter's rule was not going to act as a bar to a firefighter's claim against a citizen, again, the word rescue never occurred. In those cases, if in fact the court wanted to make this rule rest on the concept of rescue, they could have easily said no rescue was involved and we meant this rule to be a rescue type rule, but therefore it doesn't apply. That didn't happen. The first time rescue was really brought into the firefighter's rule was in the Pinter case 3 years ago. And I am not sure that that case rests entirely on the fact that the individual who was injured was a rescuer. The case talks about EMTs being specially trained to confront danger and hazards. And if you look at cases from other jurisdictions that have applied the firefighter's rule to police officers, those cases don't involve rescue either. We have a case, for example, from Alaska where a truck driver left his keys in a vehicle and left the vehicle unattended, and an intoxicated individual got into that truck, took off, and a police chase ensued. And a police officer was injured in the police chase, and he attempted to sue the negligent truck driver who left his keys in the car for his negligence. The court said the firefighter rule applies to preclude the suit by the police officer. No rescue was involved in that case. I could give you examples from other jurisdictions where that's the case, too. And the other problem with the idea of rescue being a basis for the rule is that the rule would become difficult to apply because we could have a situation where firefighters are called to a burning residence, and within 5 minutes, those firefighters get all the individuals out of the house safely. One of them is injured in the process. God bless you. But then 5 minutes later, another firefighter who is simply fighting the fire, not rescuing anyone, is injured. We'd have a situation where one of them could bring suit against the negligent fire starter where the other one couldn't. And I don't think we want to get into that type of an analysis as to whether rescue was involved or not involved in determining whether or not a firefighter or a police officer should be able to maintain a cause of action. The gist of my argument is that police officers are similar to firefighters. And the reasons for the rule that were stated 33 years ago and reaffirmed 3 years ago are equally applicable to police officers who put themselves in harm's way for the protection of the public.
Do police officers occasionally respond to assist at accident scenes and fires?
Absolutely. In fact, in one of the cases, I believe it was the Hobold case, which involved an acetylene tank that exploded. The facts indicate that a police officer was the first person on the scene of the fire. So police often respond with firefighters and EMTs to dangerous situations. In fact, they're trained in emergency medical services according to the Wisconsin Administrative Code, and their job, as I indicated earlier, is to safeguard lives and property. I don't think that many police officers would
agree with the statement that they're not in a position to rescue. If, in fact, rescue is a part of the rule, I think many police officers would argue we do help people. We do rescue people in need. And so even if that is the basis of the rule, I think there's a very good argument that it should apply equally to police officers.
Counselor, you indicated that a police officer would not be barred if there was some sort of intentional act.
Correct.
Suppose that there was a tragic incident a few years ago in Milwaukee in which a police officer was helping a motorist at the side of the road and was hit by a drunk driver. What would be the result of that case?
If the firefighter's rule were applied to police officers, that injured police officer would not be able to maintain a cause of action against the motorist he was assisting on the side of the road who may have been negligent, but he would be able to maintain a cause of action against the intoxicated driver that struck him.
And the theory for that is what?
Is that, well, again, it's public policy. We, as citizens, are encouraged to call for assistance when we need it, from firefighters, from police officers. We don't want to take matters into our own hands. We don't want citizens to think that they can handle situations without the assistance of professionals who are trained. And we don't expect that when we call someone for help, as we're encouraged to do so, that that person should be able to sue us because we did something negligent that required their services. It's too great a burden to place on the citizens.
Well, the public policy analysis, however, is not premised upon the idea that a call for help had been made. Sometimes the help comes without that call being made.
True, that's true.
Perhaps a modification of your last statement is in order. Haas doesn't talk about that.
About a call for help.
Right.
No, you're right. It's in some situations, firefighters or police officers happen upon a scene, as in this case. She happened upon the scene without being called. But I don't think that whether one is called or whether one happens upon the scene, when they're doing their job, confronting danger to protect the citizens, that the rule should allow them to maintain a cause of action against the negligent citizen.
Counselor, I want to modify Justice Prosser's hypothetical. What if the person that the officer had stopped by the side of the road was a speeder, and then he was hit by a drunk driver? Could he sue both the speeder and the drunk driver?
Well, I guess that would depend on whether speeding is negligence or intentional conduct. And I really don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
When I do it, it's negligent.
You intended to exceed the speed limit. Uh-huh. You knew that the odometer was showing, maybe it's not the odometer, the gauge is showing 80 miles an hour. You knew that. You were just taking a risk. But you didn't intend injury.
True.
And what you did was using that it was over the speed limit is negligence. I mean, this is the example that Justice Bradley gave you, that it's intentional conduct to speed, but it's negligence conduct in hitting the person. It's a fine line in there, but the law makes it all the time.
In other jurisdictions outside of Wisconsin, in every case where the firefighter's rule has been applied to firefighters, and the courts of that, those states have been asked to extend the rule to police officers, those courts have done so. There's not a case that I have been able to find, or as far as I know that opposing counsel has been able to find, which would indicate that those two professions require different treatment. Both have professional training and experience that prepares them to provide assistance under dangerous emergency conditions, and they're specially employed to confront danger. And I think that to draw a distinction between a firefighter and a police officer when determining whether the firefighter's rule should apply is illogical. It doesn't make sense to say that a firefighter can't sue when a police officer can, or vice versa. both occupations are occupations wherein the individuals are trained, they're compensated, and they're specially employed to confront these dangers that citizens create through their negligence. And the same public policy reasons that applied in Haas and applied in Pinter should apply to police officers. Now, appellant also made claims for violation of a Milwaukee County ordinance and failure to warn. And both of those claims were dismissed by the trial court. And I noticed my warning light is on, so I'll be brief, but the court properly dismissed both of those claims as well, because with respect to the violation of Milwaukee County ordinances, the question becomes whether those ordinances were enacted to protect the class of people, this being police officers, attempting to capture stray dogs. In Pinter, this court made it clear that motor vehicle code provisions were not arguably enacted to protect police officers in the performance of their duties, and I think the same can be said for these municipal code violation claims, because this code that we're talking about says that if you have a dog, you can't let it run loose, and if you have a dangerous dog, you have to muzzle it or leash it. But the code also says that if a dog's running at large, the people that should come to take care of that problem are the police. And it's inherently inconsistent to say that the people who are enforcing the ordinance were the people that the ordinance was meant to protect. Their job requires them to do it. The ordinance was meant to protect the public. They're enforcing the ordinance. It wasn't arguably intended to protect police officers. Therefore, the causes of action based on violation of ordinances must fail. With respect to the failure to warn causes of action, again, even if this court were to extend the firefighters' rule to include police officers, that cause of action must fail as well, because here there was no opportunity to warn whatsoever. I noticed my light's on, so unless the court has any further questions, I'd conclude now and ask that the court affirm the decision of the trial court granting summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Simelli, with 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
While we're sitting here, my associate, Mr. Fuchs, told me that if this were September 12, 2001, this might be a much easier argument to make. I think we do not want to apply this rule to police officers. It's inappropriate. It would only be done so based upon doctrines that this court has long since abrogated, implied assumption of risk. I think if I listened to the various hypotheticals that Justice Roggenzack and Justice Prosser pointed out, it indicates that if this rule is applied to cops, we will see a lot more tort litigation. We've gone for 30 years now, and this issue has never come up. Okay? It's never come up applying this rule to cops. They've been able to sue when they were able to establish a duty and a breach of duty and a causal connection. If this rule is applied to police officers, we will have the defense bar using it to apply it in a wide variety of situations and not just to cops. Justice Roggenzack's hypothetical is, you get a cop responding to a bank robbery and he's shot. Perhaps if the bank robber intentionally shot the cop, it's not going to apply. But what if the security guard, in trying to shoot the bank robber, misses and shoots the cop? Are you going to tell me that defense counsel for the security guard is not going to say, wait a minute, firefighter's rule, you can't sue me, even though the cop is dead because of somebody's negligence? It's going to happen. It's going to happen. When I first read Pinter, I thought, gee, this really expanded the law. I think paragraph 47 of Pinter is important to look at because it's a narrow decision. It applies the firefighter's rule to EMTs in that circumstance. And then it goes on in that same paragraph to address Haas's public policy considerations, which say why we can't let this thing go forward. And what was that? It's too attenuated, the cause and the injury. I don't think we need to, I don't know whether
HAAS has been expanded to all EMTs. I think this court can find that it has not. It was expanded to EMT Pinter given those circumstances. But if this court finds that it was expanded to apply to all EMTs, then according to the defendant, why not allow it to expand to apply to all firefighters? And then the DNR warden. And then who's next? It should be stopped. What should happen is normal concepts of tort law should apply. If the police officer cannot establish a duty, then he doesn't get to trial. If he can establish a duty and a breach and a causal connection, then he ought to get to trial. He shouldn't be prevented from getting to trial simply because he's a cop. That's wrong.
What if Thomas Pinter had been a police officer responding to that accident and was injured in the same exact way?
I think that should have been dealt with in a foreseeability context. It's simply too attenuated to claim, if the police officer's only claim was you were negligent for getting in the accident and therefore that caused me to respond and that caused me to reach in to help you and then I cut my arm. That's too attenuated. That's not foreseeable for a person who's driving down the road to think, gee, if I speed, maybe I'm going to be responsible to a cop for liability. And I think that's why allowing Pinter, whether it was a cop or a firefighter, to sue would put too great a burden on negligent drivers, because it's just too unforeseeable, it's too attenuated.
But foreseeability, when it's part of the initial determination of negligence, is a jury question, usually. And public policy is a legal question. And in Pinter, the public policy issue was resolved on that basis by, as a matter of law.
Yes, ma'am, that is correct. And I think that Pinter could have been decided without even mentioning the firefighter's rule. I think it could have been decided as a matter of law that it is unforeseeable, it is simply too attenuated to make this claim. It is essentially, the way I see it, is it was a but-for negligence claim. And we don't work that way anymore.
Your 9/11 example looks persuasive, but as I think about it, I think it falls within intentional.
I think it does.
It was an intent to kill.
It
precisely
does.
Who was going to get killed? People who drove that plane into the building didn't know. It was clearly an intent to destroy property and to kill.
I'm not arguing that the people that hijacked those planes were negligent. May I finish answering the question? Clearly they weren't. But I think after September 11th, 2001, we as a country recognized the importance of people that stand up for us and that save our lives and that protect our lives. And I don't think that we want to apply a rule of law that penalizes those individuals because they do that job. And I think that's the basis for the defendant's argument to do so. That's wrong. And that's all I meant to imply. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our argument in 02-14-16, Julia Cole versus Hubanks. Mr. Sonnelli, Mr. Fuchs, and Ms. Kane, we want to thank you all for an excellent argument. I'm sorry.